ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The next generation of homeowners wanting to buy a house in the country town where they grew up say they've been priced out as more regional towns join the so-called million-dollar club.
If I didn't ever own my own home, I think I'd be quite disappointed because Australia is meant to be like the land where you can achieve all your dreams, and it would make me very disappointed, and I would also feel like I hadn't worked hard enough to accomplish that goal.
And publicans in the bush get tough on the use of fake digital IDs.
What the publicans now have started to take is a really hard stance against this. Every single licensed premises that is part of the liquor record is backing this. So all publicans are sick of this fake stuff, and now we're really starting to push forward to try and squash this problem before it gets out of hand.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country Perth. But first to the top end of the country, which is still experiencing the impact of Tropical Cyclone Fina. A luxury wilderness resort, only accessible by sea and private charter flights, has been significantly damaged in a direct hit from Cyclone Fina, which made landfall in an extremely remote part of WA's Kimberley. However, two caretakers who were sheltering in an underground bunker managed to escape unscathed. While the cyclone didn't impact the East Kimberley towns of Kununurra or Wyndham, the remote luxury tourism resort, Berkeley River Lodge, has suffered significant damage. Darwin experienced the outer edge of severe tropical cyclone Fina on the weekend, but the eye of the storm came much closer to the Tiwi Islands, which is off the coast. Reporter Jack Hislop visited the community of Warramyanga, a 2.5-hour ferry from Darwin, and spoke to islanders, including the member for Lingiari, Marion Scrimgeour.
Marion, we're driving around the streets. What do you make of what's happened?
We see the usual damage, trees down and you know, the power lines. But the message that we take away from this is that nobody got hurt. You know, people in the community stayed safe. We had the school, we had services like Tiwi Island Regional Council, Tiwi Land Council. Everyone worked together to make sure that everyone had a safe shelter and people were fed. So, you know, people just need to work with power and water. The power will be on soon enough. They're doing the best that they can. But I think that all of the services have done a fantastic job with keeping people safe and out of danger.
And how are people coping without the power? I mean, are they going to be all right for at least a few days?
Oh, look, they'll have to. We've had the essential services staff working as fast as they can to try and get the power on. Of course, people, because it's so hot and you can feel it as you're out here, the humidity. And of course, people will, you know, feel that heat and they'll get a bit cranky about it. But all I'm saying to everyone in the community, work with the essential services people. They're doing the best that they can to make sure power is restored in the community. You know, I think that they've put certain suburbs back online. There are, you know, go to family members' house. If the power's on, go there, sit down for a while, but don't take it out on the essential services staff. Police, everyone's working together with the council to try and make sure that we can get power back on.
And the clean-up might be easier in Darwin, just with the tyranny of distance and the remoteness of the Tiwi Islands, how much more difficult does that make the recovery effort?
Yeah, look, we need to work with, you know, Heidi and Tiwi Island Regional Council, the Land Council and everyone. And it's great that, you know, both Minister McBain, who's the Federal Minister for Emergency Services, and also Minister Melandiri McCarthy have both come out. My role is to make sure that Canberra can come to these places and that their voices are heard and that we all work together to try and make particularly life better for people living in these remote communities, that we don't forget them.
My name's Ty.
Can you tell us what's happened here?
Cyclone's come through and absolutely blitzed all the trees, obviously pushed it onto the power lines, pushed it across our power station. No damage to the station, but that up and running, going pretty good.
And how many fallen trees like this are across Warramyanga?
Probably about 30, maybe 40.
And how long is it going to take to fix it all?
Get it properly up and running, maybe about another 3-4 days, and probably about a week, 2 weeks worth of cleanup.
As you drive along the streets of Warramyongo, you can really see this place has been hit much harder than Darwin. There are trees across power lines through the streets, and houses like this have been directly impacted.
Yeah, it's really strong. Like Category 3, it's a really, it's, you got to take any cyclone, you know, or the bad weather, you got to take it seriously. And I'm really scared, and everyone, you know, the elderly people, kids as well, so yeah, really.
Everyone was scared. Lucky the principal of the school told everyone to move there, because from Category 2 it turned to Category 3 and we knew it was a dangerous cyclone.
And how did you feel throughout it?
I felt really scared. Yeah, that was my first cyclone, because we had cyclone pressure before, but it was long way off. Because I'm from Melbourne Island, Billy Carpenter. We didn't get the full brunt of the cyclone, no. We only got the tail part.
Did everyone get through it? Everyone was fine?
Everyone was fine. Nobody was hurt or anything like that.
Heidi Dorn, Deputy CEO of TWL and Tertiary Council.
When's power expected to come back on?
Look, we've just heard word that power has just come back on. So it's currently still in the testing phases at the moment. There is one small area of the community that isn't back on, because we do have a major tree over it, but majority have it, which is very fortunate. But yeah, unfortunately, we're going to have a couple of days in one area. So.
It was a bit scary for a lot of people who haven't been through cyclones, like a lot of the young people and the kids, you know, and with all the noise that was coming through with the wind. So it was a bit scary for them.
Now, can you describe that noise?
It was like a wooing sound and a whistle. So it was pretty terrifying for some people who didn't, you know, actually understand what the cyclone sound is like with the wind.
And had you been through something like that before?
Yeah. Yep. So I've been a few cyclones, yep. So... But we're pretty good. We, you know, we're pretty self-sufficient, and we making sure that everyone's okay as well.
Jack Hislop reporting from the Tiwi Islands off the coast of Darwin.
ABC Australia Wide.
Yesterday on the show, we looked at ratcheting rentals in regional Australia. And today, new figures show people wanting to buy a house in many parts of the country are also being locked out. In fact, in some of Western Australian holiday hotspots, locals fear they may never own their own home after the towns joined Australia's so-called Million Dollar Club. Property researcher Cotality says one in three Australian markets now have a median house price of at least $1 million, including an increasing number of regional towns. Jackie Lynch reports from Margaret River.
Come on, chickies. Amelia Glass grew up feeding chickens and swimming in the dam on her parents' regional property in WA's southwest.
I truly think it's the best place in the world to live. And growing up here gave me a freedom that I don't think you could get anywhere else. Like, on the weekends or after school, my parents would just be like, go, be free.
It's a life the 20-year-old wants to return to once she's finished university. But her dream of owning a home in Margaret River, 270 kilometres south of Perth, is slipping further out of reach.
Right off the bat, seeing a $6 million one is great.
The median house price in Margaret River is now $1 million.
And I always thought that Margaret River would be a cheap place to live because of the fact that we're so far from the city and... we've got all these new housing developments going in, but hearing that the price has now gone up even more has kind of made the idea of living in Margaret River in the future a lot more daunting.
Even with the federal government's 5% deposit scheme for first home buyers, Amelia Glass says she'll struggle to buy in the place she loves.
When you look back a couple of generations and see how easy it was for our grandparents to buy their own homes, even on low-income jobs, even supporting multiple kids kind of thing, and it's that people my age with no dependents will find it incredibly difficult to buy a home in the future unless they can kind of rely on the bank of mum and dad.
Just down the road in Dunsborough, the median house price is also more than $1 million. The once sleepy holiday town is buzzing with tourists and locals. And Dunsborough real estate agent Julie Fairclough says demand for houses is high.
It's extremely difficult to get a house definitely under 900 in Dunsborough now. Just a normal family 3x1 or 4x2, it's very difficult. It's 900 plus, I would expect. And some houses are selling for much more than what we would envisage.
She says the market is showing no signs of slowing down.
It's just got that same vibe as the Byron Bay, north coast of New South Wales, that people love. You know, it's, I suppose it's progress. but and who knows what's gonna what the future will hold. But as long as it remains one of the most desirable places in Western Australia to be, I can't see it slowing down.
Caitlin Ezzie from property research company Cotality says 5 years ago, these kinds of seven-figure price tags were only really found in places like Sydney and regional tourism hotspots like Byron Bay.
It really started as this sort of prestige club that only a few suburbs across the country were part of. But given the strong value growth we've seen over the past couple of years, we've seen more and more markets enter that club. And so it's currently about one-third of markets across the country have that million-dollar price tag.
She says for many, that's a hard debt to pay off.
To buy a million-dollar home, your average household has to spend about sort of 55% of their income servicing a mortgage on a 20% deposit. And for those using the 5% deposit scheme, that jumps up to about 60%. And so it does raise the question of affordability for those buyers.
Southwest planner Dane Gaunt says more houses are needed, but progress is slow.
It's kind of a bit of a catch-22. We've got a housing crisis. We've got a planner shortage. We can't attract more planners to the region because they can't find housing. In terms of like specific barriers, enabling infrastructure is a big one. Power infrastructure and sewer infrastructure is massive and is causing a lot of delays.
He says it's a shared responsibility to fix the problem.
I see a lot of projects get caught up in process and it might be at the federal level, it might be at the state level, it might be at the local government level, it might be process on the developer's side. And I think it's really important to except that everything has to go through a process, but it's not process for process sake. It needs to be outcomes focused. There's real people that we're kind of trying to provide for, and I think that needs to be at the back of everyone's mind.
As Amelia Glass looks to the future, she's hoping for her own home, but fears the chance is slipping through her fingers.
If I didn't ever own my own home, I think I'd be quite disappointed because Australia is meant to be like the land where you can achieve all your dreams. And it would make me very disappointed, and I would also feel like I hadn't worked hard enough to accomplish that goal.
Jackie Lynch reporting from Margaret River in the southwest of Western Australia. Let's head now to Victoria to an unfolding story around what's commonly known as forever chemicals. The term forever chemicals refers to PFAS, a group of almost 15,000 synthetic chemicals commonly used in heat-resistant products, stain-resistant products and non-stick products. But the thing is, they can take thousands of years to break down, have been linked to numerous health concerns such as birth defects, neurological effects, kidney failure and even a variety of cancers. Until the 2000s, certain PFAS chemicals were a key ingredient in fire retardant foams used by Australian airports, military and firefighting bases for more than 30 years. Now a federal inquiry into these chemicals has recommended the government pursue legal action against the US manufacturer of these firefighting foams that have been used all around Australia. Olivia Sanders is our reporter in Warrnambool in Victoria, and she's been covering this story. Now, Olivia, firstly, who's the government pursuing in this case about forever chemicals?
Hello, Sinead. It's unclear at this stage if the government will take on board the recommendations that have been put forward in a federal inquiry into the management of these chemicals in Australia, but yes, one of those recommendations is that the federal government pursue 3M, which is the company that manufactured firefighting foam that was used across Australia for more than 30 years, as you said. And that firefighting foam was particularly effective at putting out fires because of the PFAS chemicals that were in it, but were marketed. It was marketed as non-toxic and biodegradable, which it was not.
How long is it alleged that 3M has known about the danger of these chemicals?
Look, there was testimony given to the US saying that 3M had done their own testing on animals as early as the 1950s that showed that these chemicals were toxic. But there was different studies done sort of throughout the latter half of last century that indicated the way that some of these chemicals could impact blood of humans and animals.
Olivia, in covering this story, you saw a copy of a letter which indicates a cover-up of relevant information. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, so I had seen a letter that was sent to Fire Services Victoria back in 2023. It was from the then Victorian Emergency Services Minister, Jacqueline Symes, who had the authority to stop Fire Rescue Victoria from participating in a class action litigation that was, you know, going to be taken, I guess, or actioned on 3M, which is the company that makes the firefighting foam, to hold them responsible, or attempting, the goal of it was to hold them responsible, accountable for paying the remediation costs for environments that are damaged by this firefighting foam. So the class action, I don't have an extensive list of the different groups that were involved, but apparently it involved many of the firefighting services across Australia. But that Fire Services Victoria was to be the lead litigant, and by not giving permission for Fire Services Victoria to participate, it effectively caused the class action to be abandoned, which means that 3M never sort of, you know, got held accountable for the effects of that firefighting foam in Australia. They have been, you know, held accountable in different, or had litigation brought to them in different jurisdictions around the globe. I think probably a really good one to bring up is that last year, or it might have been 2023, they actually settled for more than $10 billion, with a B, US dollars, with the host of the US public water system. So that case never went to court, but it was to do with PFAS contaminating water systems in the US, and they settled within that case.
Olivia, going back to this letter, have you spoken to her about why that decision was made? Why, as Emergency Services Minister, did she make that decision? Do we know why?
Yeah, look, I posed that question to Jacqueline Symes, who's now the Victorian Treasurer, but at the time was the Emergency Services Minister, and I was not given a straightforward answer. But in reading the letter, reputational risks are cited, as well as legal and policy risks. So, yeah, I did sort of ask exactly what those risks are or would be, but I wasn't given a straight answer on that one.
You also spoke to Fire Rescue Victoria Chief Fire Officer Mick Tixbury. And what did he say about the Minister's decision back in 2023?
Yeah, look, he actually said that he was dumbfounded by the decision, and seemed to think it was, yeah, in his words, he just couldn't really understand why that was the decision that was made.
It was kicking the guts. It was a no-brainer. And it would also send a very powerful message, not only at 3M, but also all those other multinational chemical companies who knowingly conceal health effects of their products that they just put on. Fortunately, a lot of these companies, the bottom line is their dollar, and that's all they care about. So the only way to get them to wake up to themselves is holding to account, and that's hit them in the hip pocket. And if they've been misleading in their information they supply about their products, well, they need to be held to account.
An emotional Chief Fire Officer Mick Tixbury there, speaking to our reporter Olivia Sanders. Now, Olivia, what did Mick Tixbury have to say about the repercussions for firefighters in what is essentially a delay in litigation?
Yes, well, so the litigation was, as I said, to sort of hold 3M accountable for paying the remediation costs of environments damaged by their toxic firefighting foam. I know that Mick Tisbury from Fire Rescue Victoria feels, I guess, a sense of guilt over the fact that as a firefighter, he's trying to protect the community and feels that this has potentially harmed the community that they were trying to protect.
We signed up to protect the community and the environment when we join the job. Now, we know there's you know, inherent risks in our job, but that's just what we do for a living. And so 100% feel guilty for potentially inadvertently harmed the community that was supposed to be protecting because of the lies of 3M over a product that we used. We feel enormously guilty about that.
That's Fire Rescue Victoria Chief Fire Officer Mick Tixbury. Now, the inquiry has recommended pursuing legal action, but does this mean it will definitely go ahead?
No, it doesn't mean it will definitely go ahead. It really is up to the federal parliament to decide what they do with the recommendations that have been brought to them in this report from the inquiry. So, yeah, I mean, I guess we're still sort of, it's a wait and see at the moment.
Olivia Sanders in Warrnambool, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
ABC Australia Wide.
Being handed a fake ID at a regional Queensland pub used to be a pretty rare occurrence, but now publicans are reporting multiple per week digital fake IDs. Using a fake or false ID can result in big fines, and there's security risks as well. Grace Whiteside popped into a Bundaberg hotel to find out exactly what the staff are contending with.
Before digital IDs, I think I've had one fake ID in like 15 years basically, so, and whereas now we're getting multiple per week.
Chris Simons is on the front line of the latest battle for publicans, fake digital IDs. He's the manager at the Sugarland Tavern in Bundaberg, almost 400 kilometres north of Brisbane.
It's widespread and you've got to really be vigilant because it's really hard to pick up.
There's only one way to know if a digital ID is real, by scanning the QR code.
Not everywhere is using the verifier ID, and at a first glance they all look legitimate, but the only way you can definitely check is using the Queensland Government's verifier app to make sure that it is actually a legitimate licence.
But you need a different app for licences from other states, and Chris reckons some minors are taking advantage of that loophole and getting fake digital New South Wales driver licences to use as an ID. A Transport for New South Wales spokesperson said driver licences and photo cards contain a number of security features to protect individual identity, such as holograms and watermarks. In a statement, they said Transport for New South Wales, Service New South Wales and New South Wales Police continue to work together to strengthen and validate proof of identity across both physical card and digital driver licences.
I know some venues now absolutely refuse New South Wales digital IDs. If you've got New South Wales digital, you either get your hard copy or you don't come in.
Lloyd Finnis is the president of the Bundaberg Bagara Liquor Accord, which encompasses about 20 licensed venues in the region. He says fake IDs are becoming so prevalent, they've implemented new rules for minors trying to sneak in.
What the publicans now have started to take is a really hard stance against this. Once they're caught and we know that they're underage and they are trying to gain access to the venue, they get a birthday present before they turn 18 and they're not allowed in the venue until they're 19. And every single licensed premises that is part of the liquor record is backing this. So all publicans are sick of this fake stuff and now we're really starting to push forward to try and squash this problem before it gets out of hand.
The Queensland Department of Customer Services says the most secure way to validate a digital licence is by scanning the QR code with the Verifier app, which can be downloaded by venues for free. A spokesperson says Queensland licences meet strict international security and privacy standards, and fake digital licences will not pass when scanned with the Verifier. Meanwhile, the Office of Liquor and Gaming Regulations says it regularly engages with licensees to reinforce the need for vigilant ID checks of both physical and digital forms and provides them with practical industry information and guidance.
That fine is coming at a very big privacy and threat scam.
Priyanka Singh is a lecturer of cybersecurity at the University of Queensland. She says the use of artificial intelligence, or AI, has made making fake IDs quite simple, but warned young people of the additional dangers they're opening themselves up to by asking someone to create a fake ID with their personal information.
They just think it as, you know, something to go and have fun, but it's even more than that. It's bigger than that. Because they're compromising their information, their personal information that can be later on used for scams. There should be proper, you know, training and education, even at the school level. Like, so there should be more training on that part to give them, you know, what they're compromising if that fund is coming at a very big privacy and threat scam. It's going to be more challenging and challenging, you know, because these tools will keep coming. And the only way is more awareness and, more training around that.
Back in Bundaberg, hotel manager Chris Simon's primary concern is for his staff and what could happen if they don't identify an ID as fake.
Tens of thousands of dollars of fines potentially, not just for the staff that serve them, for the manager, for the hotel. You're not super careful, it can be very, very expensive.
Grace Whiteside with that report. Back in 2000, there was an idea to change the one-size-fits-all approach to education for young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men. The idea was an academy would be embedded into existing schools that used a passion for sport to equip boys with skills that would stay with them far beyond school years. 25 years later, there are Clontarf academies all over this country, and the biggest is in far north Queensland, where Juanita Sopper went along to find out why, for some students, celebrating their graduation was something they once could never have imagined.
Yeah, I love all the uncles here that teach us a lot. Makes me, like, feel good about my culture and that.
Without Clontarf, I don't know where I'd be today. You know, they've really gotten me out of my shell in my junior years. And I've made tons of memories. I've been a part of a, you know, wonderful community that's developed me into a young man.
Trinity Bay High School, with a population of just under 1,800 students, is a melting pot of nationalities, including 30% First Nations students. Deputy Principal Angela Howarth of Senior Secondary was at the school in 2016 when the Clontarf Academy first began.
I was a maths teacher here back then, so a bit different to my current role. What we saw back then was the boys getting this little bit of assistance, and we didn't really understand what it was all about. It was so new. Whereas nowadays, my goodness, the stuff that these guys do for our boys, the support they give them, the mentorship, everything from taking them to class, staying there for a few minutes so they get settled and ready to learn. You know, all these little things that go such a long way to helping our kids excel.
Matthew Handorf is the regional manager of the Clontarf Foundation, Far North Queensland region, of which there are seven academies, including Weipa, Yarrabah, Gordonvale, Bentley Park, Warree, Cairns High and Trinity Bay.
The biggest region in the country, and the guys do a fantastic job here, and I suppose getting outcomes for the boys of getting to school, stay at school, finish school and go into employment or university.
And I heard the graduation the other night was pretty special.
Yeah, so each year every academy has an awards night, and that's an opportunity for us to celebrate the boys, their achievements throughout the year, and that stretches from year 7 through to year 12. We're measured on a few KPIs, so one's attendance, one's year 12 completion. We look at retention as well, but we're also working with the guys on pathways after school. So that's sort of what we look at as a national program, and we're no different here in Far North Queensland. We're always trying to aim for that 80% attendance for averages of coming to school, but I suppose the other aspect of our programs are that it's an holistical approach. So some of these kids have challenges coming to school and what that is, and we provide, I suppose, we break down those barriers so they can get to school, have a feed, in their uniform, feel comfortable to attend a camp, and I suppose get to the end of year 12 and stand up in front of people to thank their family, you know, the people who've supported them throughout that journey, and then go on and be supported by Clontarf after they finish school. So we have employment officers that help with that as well. So they don't just leave school and they're off to their devices. We've got a group of men here that actually support them through making sure they're going into employment, university, and they're comfortable as their journey out of school is.
Shai Bird, the director of the Clontarf Academy at Trinity Bay High School, oversees the 290 Year 7 to Year 12 students currently enrolled, the biggest cohort in the country.
Twice a week we'll be in the vans from 6 a.m. getting around to the boys' place to pick them up, get them here on site, whether it's here on site at school or an alternate venue, but for morning training. So we'll train for about an hour, all fun-based games. It's not about an excellence program or anything, but a lot of fun-based games that get the boys excited to get here. We'll provide breakfast for those guys and then get them off to school for the day.
Hi, my name's Terence Davidson. I'm a current Year 12 student at Trinity Bay State High School, and I'm a part of the Clontarf program. For next year, I've been accepted into CQU to study a Bachelor in Engineering. I'm hoping to major in Mechanical Engineering. I've also started my ADF application, so I'm looking to become a Naval Officer.
What was it about the program that really spoke to you?
Looking back at it, at my Grade 7 self, although I was intrigued by all the camps and excursions and the fun experiences that it had, I definitely had to say that, you know, it was boys being a family, you know, building that brotherhood in here. it's really inspired me to be better, and it always drew me in there. You know, there's just that familyhood. You know, with the support of Klontoff and, you know, many other people that, you know, and I'm able to grow into, you know, the sort of person that, you know, I want to be for my community.
Terence Davidson, one of Clontarf Academy's finest and amongst the 41 First Nations students graduating at Trinity Bay High School this year. And thanks to Juanita Sopper for that story. And that is Australia Wide for this Tuesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.